Do not erase that.
Okay, it's gone.
Okay, well.
We're not, we're technological.
Okay, so, thanks everybody for putting up with us tonight. We did change your schedule a little bit. I think we were originally scheduled for a precept ceremony, and then we'll probably have to alter the presentation because one of the presenters isn't here, so there's another conflict that we have. That's great. So I think that Connie mentioned that what we're going to talk about, we're going to share with you some of the information that we got from an understanding conflict workshop that the Whatcom Dispute Center put on. And thanks, by the way, to the board and to the Sangha for giving us the opportunity to go. Seven of us were able to be there, so it's really, you know, nice that so many of us could attend. So I do want to mention that both John and I had talked about it and really agreed that a lot of the information that we got from the Dispute Resolution Center was very compatible with a document that we had developed. And those of you who aren't familiar with the document,
Ethical Guidelines for the Red Sea or Zen Community Practicing with Difficulty. So it's ethics and precepts and conflict resolution tips and that kind of thing.
Right, and that is on the back table there. So if anybody isn't familiar with it or you are interested in looking it over, take one with you. I think there's about 10 copies back there. So it's good to familiarize yourself with it.
I think it's on our website, too.
Is it?
Is it?
Maybe?
Yeah, we just rediscovered that it was there.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Okay. So we have
business
that.
Business and policies.
I wanted to say that I was very enthusiastic when I came back. And for about 2 weeks, I was asking Jeff if we couldn't have a conflict. And at one point I said, well, why don't we go out on a date? And if we go out on this date like we used to do, before we were married and kind of courting, oh, we could have a conflict. And wouldn't that be cool? But he didn't buy into it. But it'll happen. Believe me, it'll happen. So I guess we want to know, since we all feel that we have a pretty benign community, at least we've expressed that before, why are we doing this? Well, we do have a pretty benign community, really. We haven't really had any major ethical breaches like some of the communities across the country have, or really any major blow-ups or any splits. But people do get frustrated. And if we are in relationship, and if we're human beings, we'll get into conflict eventually at some point. Certainly there have been frustrations and there have been disagreements, and it's good to address all of this. And the other thing I want to mention is that we have this wonderful gift of Sangha as a laboratory where we can practice compassion in this, and we can also practice living harmoniously together. We do share the same values, and we have taken the same vows, and we have a commitment to end suffering. So we do have a basis, I think, to trust one another and to feel safe here. So there are some ways, though, we can bump into each other in Sangha life. And Edie and I did a role play on this one at one time, you folks remember, but one area is in the roles and the tasks that we have, and we might find that we need some autonomy, perhaps, in our role, and then somebody else maybe steps in. Maybe we put something on the website and somebody else changes it or interferes in some way. So we might get into a conflict or a disagreement that way. On the other side of that, we might have a project that we're undertaking and we feel like we need some help and the help doesn't show up, like tonight, for example. and that could develop into a conflict. Or we might not have a conflict with an individual person. It could be that we don't like the decisions that the practice committee or the board has made or Tim has made, and we feel conflicted about that. Or maybe we don't like the decision-making process and feel like we could be part of it. So we have lots of opportunities here. But I think an important thing to note is that all of our conflicts won't be resolved. We really can't get everything that we need. It could just be a personality clash. And in which case, we have an opportunity here to learn some patience and how to live with each other with equanimity. So a little bit about the model that was presented to us at through the Dispute Resolution Center. It's referred to as an interest and needs-based model. And it understands that that perceived needs are at the root of our conflict. I mean, conflict actually arises from within ourselves, arises internally, but our habit seems to be that we project it outward, and we tend to attribute it to something external. And it's really more that we feel our strategies, not necessarily maybe our needs, but the strategies to meet the conflict, we feel that they're blocked. They get blocked, and then we get frustrated, and we clash. So there are other models or other methods for resolution out there, and these aren't the interest-based models, but one is a power-based model. And in a power-based model, it's kind of my way or the highway, and it's often done through threats and coercion. But we see that with like our foreign affairs, if we impose a sanction on another country or an embargo, that kind of thing. Or also in an emergency situation, you know, you call 911, you go to the door and meet the medics, that kind of thing. So it can be useful in emergencies and actually beneficial. There's also position-based methods. And resolution for those type of methods is done through usually laws, rules or regulations or standards, that kind of thing. But the goals of this interest-based model are really different. These goals are relational. And the intention is not just to assert our own needs, but also to attend and to understand the needs of the other party. It's a movement from my goals to our goals. And as I mentioned, it's very compatible with the one that we have in our own document here. And it also understands that conflict does not have to be negative and alienated. And with proper management and skills and awareness, it can lead to, really can lead to greater intimacy and connection. So I'll pass it over to John.
Okay, thanks. So there was a great deal of material presented in 6 hours, 2 3-hour classes, and we just picked 3 or 4 different areas that we thought were most important and most interesting, but there's so much we're not going to be able to cover. So we're just going to touch on a few things. And I'll start with this, which is a typical cycle that someone might go through if they're in a conflict. And I would say we're talking medium to high conflict, not just a mild disagreement with somebody, because those happen all the time and aren't, I don't think you would go through a cycle like this. But it starts with a trigger, and that can be a word or a behavior or a situation that pushes our buttons. So when that happens, the body starts to respond, and you get things like the heart rate might increase, blood pressure goes up, muscles start to get tense, maybe you clench your jaw or make a fist, or you feel tension in your stomach or your shoulders. And breathing can change. Breathing can become more rapid or shallow. And now we're all different, so different people have different triggers. And one of the things that's highly recommended both in the class and in our document is that you learn what your triggers are and when they get activated. And when they get activated, another thing that happens is blood flow. If they're activated long enough, blood flow begins to change. Blood begins to flow to the they refer to as the survival parts of the brain and the body, the big muscles
arms and legs and away from the cerebral cortex where we do our thinking and to the more instinctual parts of the brain. So if the triggers go on long enough, you get to the escalation stage, and that's when symptoms start to increase. So there might be at that point sweating, someone, you might feel frozen, like I don't know what to say or do. And that part of the reason that can happen is when blood flow goes out of the cerebral cortex, it is harder to think. And then if you go far enough on the escalation stage, it's really hard to come back down. You have to go this route. The top of the cycle is crisis, and at that point, maximum blood flow has gone to the survival parts of the body, and the instinctual part of the brain might be thinking, should I run? Should I hide? Should I strike out? Should I yell? You know, some kind of a drastic action. And then the next one is recovery. And at this point, things are starting to return to the way they were. So hormones that have been released, like adrenaline, would start to be reabsorbed. The blood flow starts to return to normal. Breathing might become more relaxed and deeper, and muscles start to relax. And then the last stage, depression. Blood sugar is temporarily depleted, and a person might feel tired or just kind of worn out, and feel some mild physiological depression. And depending on what happened in the conflict, there can be regret, guilt, that kind of thing. But I actually found the most interesting part of the whole cycle is here, what I labeled window on either side here. The instructor might have said balcony. I wrote down window in my notes, so I'm sticking with window. But this is a place early in the triggering. You can't use this if you're too far along on the cycle. Early in the triggering to do an assessment. And she used the example of firefighters. They're trained. You know, when they show up for a fire, they're going to get triggered by all that's going on there. And they're trained early on to look for this window. And that's where you, like, they'll go into a fire and they'll say, okay, what's burning? You know, is it wood? Is it metal? Are there people inside the building? Where are the fire hydrants? How much hose do we have? You know, what's the best way to handle this? And that's exactly the opportunity people have early in a conflict, and that is to make an assessment. So in a conflict, that might look like, what's the issue here? Is it important? You know, do I need to get involved in it, or can I just let it happen? What are my needs? What might the other person's needs be? What assumptions am I making about the other person? Maybe what's the best way to handle this, or what's the best language to use? And if you do that, if you're able to catch the window, usually this cycle, it changes the cycle. The crisis point won't be as high. The cycle will resolve sooner. And usually, because you've had a chance to reflect on how to handle a conflict, you'll have a better outcome than if you just react and kind of say or do whatever comes to mind. And then, as I said before, if you go too far in escalation, you can't catch, you've missed the window. But it's not too late to decide, I'm taking a little break. So the recommendation is do something physical to dispel some energy, get away from the situation, give yourself some time to think a little bit about what's going on and what do you want to do about it. And as Kate said, this model fits really well with the material in this document. If you're a regular meditator, undoubtedly you're going to be much more aware of what's happening in your body. That's certainly one of the things we do on the cushion, is just pay attention to the breath, pay attention to how the body feels from head to toe. And if you do that regularly, you'll find that sensitivity happens off the cushion too, so it's really handy. Much easier to know what your triggers are and when they've gotten when they've gotten activated. And then the other thing that's in this document is a recommend. We have some parts of it that are recommendations for conflict resolution. And the first part is, before doing anything to resolve a conflict, look at yourself. Look at how you're feeling. Look at what the issues are for you, what your needs are. Think about what's going on with the other person. This is exactly what the window is for, to make an assessment, not only of yourself, but of the situation you're in before you take any action. So, and I won't go through all the things that are in this document, but pages 7 to 11 have lots of suggestions about how to handle conflict and tips for resolving. So, and then the other thing that's helpful, besides learning what your triggers are and when they get activated, is to know a little bit about what's your usual style of conflict. You know, how do you usually handle a conflict when you get into one? And over time, if you can develop one or two alternatives to that, it just gives you more flexibility, especially if you have a way of handling conflict that doesn't work very well. And there's stuff in here and in our training about that too, and I know you're going to talk about that a little bit later tonight.
Styles
of
that
conflict.
Was Chris's job.
I know.
I've got.
Yeah, you've got. Yeah. So now I'll turn it back over to you.
And if you want to fight about it.
Yeah. We'll do that.
So what I'm going to do is flip the page here and hope nothing falls apart. Okay.
Let me give her that.
What's that?
The recorder.
Oh. Okay.
So we're sharing now. That's nice. So what I've drawn up here is it's really using the same model, this interest and needs-based model, but I guess it's sort of subsumed under there. And it's called the iceberg model. And what's on the top of the iceberg here, these are things that are apparent and conscious to us in a disagreement or in a negotiation. And then actually the majority of what happens in a negotiation is not necessarily aware or conscious. So it's underneath the water here. So what's up top are, I've got my pencil. I don't, so I'll just wing it here. Is the issue and the position of the parties. So the issue is sort of the what of the conflict. It's what happened, actually. And what I'm going to do is give you a little scenario, and I'm going to use the same scenario that we used in the workshop. So the issue I'm going to present is there are these two neighbors, and this neighbor's tree is caught in the windfall and lands in this neighbor's property. And this neighbor's position, or this neighbor's position, is that you should clean this up and you're going to haul it away. And this neighbor's position is you're going to have your homeowner's insurance take care of this. Okay, so those are their positions, and this is what is above and what everybody's aware of when they enter into the conflict. And then underneath here is this subcategory of interests, what we call interests. And under there are these hopes, desires, concerns, needs, fears, feelings, really all kinds of stuff is sitting below the surface here. History is here, but these are the general categories. So this is our little scenario. First of all, you might wonder, well, why is this stuff so important? Well, it turns out statistically that 80% of our conflict is due to misunderstanding. So that's, a heck of a lot of stuff that's sitting underneath here. So it's the fuel that drives it. And it's also been shown that if we can increase our understanding and if we can increase our awareness, then actually the time and the intensity of the conflict will decrease. So it's, pragmatic, really. And also, interests are easier to reconcile. than these positions are. The positions, we get hardened in a position. It's either yes or no, or black or white, or a lot of times positions are also an I am position, and we identify with I am pro-choice, I am, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, or I am a liberal, I am a conservative, and we actually begin to form our identity around that, and they're really harder to break. So they're broader if we use our interests. We have more options if we use our interests. So I'll give a little different example. So let's pretend these two guys have a tree on their boundary, and they're fighting over the tree, and they don't know who's, well, they're arguing over which who actually owns this tree. So this guy over here says, you know, I'm really interested in the shade from that tree. And this guy over here says, well, I like the apples. And so then they can come together, and you can say, well, I only need some apples for some pie. You can have the rest of them. And the other guy says, well, you know, I don't have to really delimb the tree too much, and you can have the shade. And then, so you can work with it. I mean, that's a real simple, you know, example, but you can apply it to more complex situations. Then if we get into really going a little bit deeper here, and we start looking at the things down at the bottom here, the needs and the fears, if we present or address those needs and fears as universal needs and fears. I want to say here that in our training, they, as far as I remember, they really didn't get into universal needs. Like those of you who have taken any classes in nonviolent communication, I know you have, Edie, and some others of us might have, but they really stress understanding needs as universal. Universal needs such as safety, physical or emotional, needs for connection, for contribution, needs for beauty, rest. So the things that we can all identify with. And actually, I did put a list up there from the nonviolent communication people of, it's just a brief one. They have really long, extensive ones, if you want to look at that or pick that up when you're done here. But so what's important about making these universal? Well, it seems kind of obvious if we relate to our needs this way and we share them in that manner, then we also have a sense of our common humanity. We have a sense of our sameness, and we can become more sensitive to one another, and we can feel more empathy to one another. So we can begin our, you know, conflict resolution on that basis. And they also help us to understand that we're mutually responsible for solving this problem. And eventually, we will address more specific needs as the time goes on in the procedure. And I was thinking about this too, and then also take some willingness in the process to be transparent and vulnerable. And Mary was saying, that's the teacher, she was saying that often our needs and fears down here at the bottom of this little iceberg people tend to feel reluctant about expressing them. She's done like 20 years of conflict resolution. She's seen this over time, and there seems to be some hesitancy. But I think it's important to consider this vulnerability and transparency, particularly if the relationship is more intimate and we're committed to it, it's going to be a longer range. So we want to be able to really increase our understanding in those kind of relationships. But sometimes we may not feel safe, or we may not trust each other well enough. And if trust is not at a maximum, we can take the opportunity to get to know the person better over time, and we can take the whole process just step by step and a little slower than we might want to. And we can also really begin to have more compassion for our own needs and understand those a little bit better and examine them more deeply if we're, you know, not yet able to really share that with the other person. So now we're moving on to the next step, which would really be to identify with this other fellow over here what concerns we have that are mutual, So in this particular scenario, they're probably both interested in having a neighborly relationship. Or they may be interested in the safety. This thing has fallen over the other guy's yard and kids are playing in it, so they might be concerned about that. They may be concerned about the financial outlay that they have. So now that they've acknowledged one another and they've also acknowledged that they even share their interests, the positions are softened. And hopefully they won't rise up to the top of that arc that John was showing you, at the top of that bell curve. So now you're ready to begin some trade-offs in the process. And it's ideal to begin with some lower grade trade-offs. In this case, maybe you can trade the firewood off, or maybe I'm willing to pay a third of the cost, or I'll help you chop the wood, or something like that. And you may find that your conflict is over at that point, but if you still haven't reached or you still decided on a harder bottom line, at least you're in a position to not blow up. Usually, we hope so, after going through this process. So, and the idea is through the whole process to continue to stay curious, to be curious, and to continue listening to the other partner. How am I doing? Am I talking too long, John?
Well, I was thinking we forgot to mention we're happy to take questions as we go.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you have any now or as we go along.
Just raise your hand. Okay. I just have a few things, and then we can move on to what we don't know much about. So, a couple of things more. Good things to remember are, number one, this does take practice. It's wonderful to have your intention to consider each other, to understand one another. But it's also important to have the skills. And so practice is really helpful here. And it might feel stilted at first. Maybe we'll have an opportunity. Well, we will have an opportunity to talk about some of these skills, and you practice them, and at first you think, oh, this sounds really corny or sounds really artificial. But it really helps. You know, John's talking about these old brains, the reptilian and the mammalian brains, and to really get over that fight or flight response or reaction, we have to do a lot of training. And it's okay if we fail, or if we fight, or if we embarrass ourselves, or embarrass the other person. It's okay, because it's really a learning opportunity that we have. We can begin to acknowledge and recognize where we might be falling short, and we can also become aware of where we might have hurt or offended the other person. And in so doing, we can express our regrets and apologize, and I don't mean to grovel about it, but a sincere apology really goes a long way in mending relationships, and it isn't an indication of weakness. Oh, can I say one more?
Sure.
Okay. there's this other study, and you know, I don't know where I found it, because I didn't know I'd be talking about this at the time, but there was a study done of business executives, and they were surveying their attitudes toward conflict in the workplace and how they dealt with this. And 85% of them said they avoided conflict in the workplace. Confronting these issues in the organization. And they didn't want to appear weak or that they weren't in control. Or they just felt that they didn't have the time. So I think we want to be aware of what the consequences are when we have a question.
Is that to say that they avoid conflict between, like, they're the manager, they're avoiding the conflict amongst the people they're managing, or they themselves try to just not conflict with anyone?
I think it was just in general. Either, you know, their own peers and supervisors and people that they were managing. You know, they mentioned that they didn't want to get embroiled, you know, and also this factor of time. Yeah, so I think, you know, like I said, I would have paid more attention if I thought I was going to talk about it. But
it seems to me like maybe, wouldn't you think people sometimes avoid conflict because they've always decided the other person is wrong? That's so why you love it.
Yeah, that's a thought. But you know, I don't know. Maybe there's more impotent to go head to head in a conflict when you do think the other person
is
wrong. I think that's more what it is. Yeah. Yeah. But I want to mention the consequence. The consequence of not taking the time and not doing it is that people leave. People leave the organization. So I think it's really important to remember that here with us. And so if we are ever attempted or, you know, considering avoiding a conflict, to remember what those consequences are and ask ourselves if we've really let it go. So it's important to really let it go. Otherwise, it just festers with people and builds up. And then if they don't feel like there's an open environment for it, then they just leave. So that's it on this, I guess.
Do you want to do the tips for resolving conflict or the styles of conflict?
Maybe since we know what we're doing with that, why don't we do that?
Well, we've got handouts, tips for resolving conflict, and we thought we'd just have maybe each person can read one and pass it on to the next person.
So one is stay curious. It's important to remind yourself to stay curious about yourself and how you're interacting. Curiosity leads to more understanding, learning, and growth. It helps you get to the bottom of the iceberg. Remember, wherever there is conflict, there is opportunity.
Number two, recognize your own triggers and respect those of others. It is important to become aware of what your own triggers are, as well as to learn more about what triggers those around you. The more awareness you have for yourself, the better able you are to learn how to intervene positively.
Three, recognize your own physical responses. Remember that our bodies can respond very quickly when triggered and also give us extraordinary clues about our own well-being. It's also essential to be aware of the responses of others and to not make assumptions.
Four, recognize when you are escalating and when you need to step away. Because our quality of judgment declines as our emotion and adrenaline escalates, we have to train ourselves to step away and de-escalate before engaging in important conversations.
Five, be intentional and deliberate in your communication. Think about what you want to achieve and what will get you there. We often lose sight of this when we have escalated, reminding ourselves and others that we want a positive outcome and that we don't want to fight will help shape our communication.
Six, use language that will minimize the possibility of defensiveness. Since we can only control ourselves, we must remember to speak from our own experience and to not use blaming or criticizing language. Focusing on behavior and not people keeps the topic neutral and not personal.
Seven, recognize when someone else is escalated and identify if and how you are contributing. You may not be escalated, but if the other person is, it may not be a good time to have those important conversations. Consider what you might do to help them. Reflect, reframe, clarify.
Eight, focus on needs, whether they are psychological, procedural, or physical, etc.
Nine, be thoughtful when choosing the when and where to discuss a conflict. Neutral, safe locations can help the conversation stay productive.
And number 10 is listen. And Kate and I thought that should be put in between every number. If you're not listening, you're not gonna work anything out. I think that's the most important thing of all.
Yeah. Should we do this?
Yeah. So this is the part of the presentation that neither Kate and I prepared for, and but we thought it was important. We in the class went over different styles of conflict, and we thought for us we could maybe take a look at each one, and people could volunteer what are the advantages and disadvantages of each style of conflict. So the first one is avoiding. Any advantages, Tim?
Well, it might be sometimes it's good to just take a break, right? So avoiding can be a way of helping both parties cool down. On the bad side, you may not get to a resolution of the issue, and it just sort of sits around and you get back to it.
Yeah, if it's a big one, it's not going to go away.
Yeah, or you may just sit there and hate the other person for the fact that you haven't resolved it.
I often, in a conflict, I don't respond, don't know how to do, what to do. So in a sense, I'm avoiding, but I usually afterwards figure it out either to reflect on my own behavior or go back and talk to the person. Mm-hmm.
So it can give you time
yeah.
to kind of
yeah.
figure out what the how best to handle it.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any?
I just remember this from the class. People come to you. Instead of you're talking about the problem or addressing a solution, if you avoid it, people have to come to you to get the problem solved. So I guess that puts you in a little bit more of a power position sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, I think she said this was the most powerful position. It can be.
Yeah.
Well, now, Bob?
An extension of Connie's thought is if the other person obviously in a position where they don't want to listen to you, it's a good time to put for you to avoid the conflict and put it aside rather than try and press it.
Or if the time is just not right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You might be perfectly willing to talk about it, but it's just not a good time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, on the lines of that, I was thinking about that before where there's times where someone really just is not open to discussing something, is really held on to their understanding, you know, whether it be right or wrong. And can you say anything about, like, if there's, like, a certain line where you just have to let it go?
Well, I think, you know, that depends. It'd be a different line for each situation. I think if you've tried everything you can and there's nothing left, that would be a time. Or if you felt like you were escalating and about to, you know, say or do something that would make things worse, that would also be a time.
If it's something within the Sangha, and like I had a problem with I just asked him if he would be assistant, you know, and he agreed, but then he's off and he's always too busy and he won't come and he won't talk about it. We have two Sangha stewards, if there's a problem where we can't get a resolution, we can go to people who have been trained, Kate and John, or John, and talk to them about it and try to get some help in how to approach the problem or what to do. I hope that was appropriate to bring that up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because that was something we decided when we were doing the original document for the Sangha, was to have two people who would act as Sangha stewards and get some training and confrontation. And that also means, like, if I'm someone who's only been coming for a month, and all of a sudden I have a really big conflict with Tim's, for example, there's someone else I can talk to. So it sort of creates an even playing field, I think.
Yeah, Ken.
This is just a comment. I mean, it just the conflict strategies, avoiding, what's coming to mind is Congress. Okay, because I mean, to me, that's the most pathologic. It may be the most powerful, but what's happening? If you look at Congress as an example, these guys are avoiding getting anything done,
right?
Because they're just holding to their positions. They're staying far apart. They're avoiding the issues, right? And as a result, there's been like zero effective legislation for 7.5 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe longer.
So it just really hit me.
That's
that,
it.
That is the most pathologic of all the possible ones. It may be the most powerful, but it's also the least likely to get anything finished.
Yeah.
Well, that's their plan. They're accomplishing what they're trying to do.
I would just one other thing about avoiding. I think with a little thing, avoiding is a skillful response. With little problems, you know, because you don't want to spend all your time tangling over small things.
Yeah, accepting what the person is doing.
Yeah. If you're in a traffic jam, and you can't do anything about it, you might as well have a way to be okay with it.
That's accommodating.
That's accommodating. Yeah, it's way down.
That's another thing. You're just sort of letting the other person have their way. You're accommodating them. That's a complicated solution by avoiding them. It's just like, okay, fine. It's not important to me. You know, you can have the peppermint and tea bag. I don't want it, but you can have it, right?
Yeah.
And that's accommodating somebody else, right? So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where it may be appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these things have their advantages and their disadvantages. Yeah. Yeah.
So we can go do. Should we go to the next one, which is
competing.
Advantages and disadvantages.
That's where you get the big fight.
Yeah.
You can.
How did they describe competing?
Here, I got it in here. It says, the competing style is an assertive and uncooperative course pursuing interest at the expense of others. This is a power-oriented mode in which one uses whatever power seems appropriate to win one's own position. Competing may mean standing up for your rights, defending a position that seems just, or fighting for the sake of winning. So... they do have advantages here, however.
Yeah, with an ethical problem or discrimination or something dangerous,
mm-hmm.
you know, to say this has to be the way.
It's fast. No, well, in an emergent situation, something in an emergency.
Yeah.
A lot of the advantages that are actually listed in the book don't sound too advantageous to me. Satisfaction from winning, it is.
Yeah.
Get straight to the point.
Yeah.
Releases stress off for somebody, I guess. So,
Hasn't it shown that catharsis doesn't really actually relieve anything in the long run, then?
What's that?
Catharsis. I mean, if you're like, it says relieving stress, but if you're relieving stress by fighting, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Even if that like temporarily gives you relief, it seems like building that habit of karma wouldn't really relieve your stress in the long run.
Well, that's why I said I don't really necessarily think these things are advantages in the long run. In the long run, they're probably not, you know. Maybe.
So then we have compromising. I guess I have the objective for this style is to find an expedient, mutually acceptable solution that partially satisfies both parties. It falls on a middle ground between competing and accommodating. Compromising means giving up more than one would in a competition, but less than one would if accommodating. The issue is addressed directly, yet not in depth or collaboratively. Compromising might mean splitting the difference, exchanging concessions, or seeking a quick middle ground.
I don't know if I'm ready to.
That compromise is necessary when people really are polarized.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where Congress is.
Yeah.
That's what they're necessary.
And that's what they're not doing. Yeah. Yeah.
No one's really happy with the solution.
I mean, a good compromise is when everybody's equally unhappy with the outcome.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It also, in terms of Sangha relationships, it lacks intimacy. It lacks tapping into that deeper level we were talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of sounds like it's, when I hear compromise, it kind of sounds like that's what you're supposed to do, but it has a kind of ickiness to it too, you know?
Yeah, like I guess
it kind of this quality of like, okay, we'll just end it here by compromising and not really find out, you know, what really is going on or what the real needs are. Maybe it's like things stay hidden maybe in some way with some compromises.
That sounds like one
sort
of
like a fake resolution.
Not a very deep,
deep
resolution, as you were saying, not very intimate.
So maybe we should just, collaborating is nice.
So you want to read what they...
So here's what they say collaboration is. The collaborator is assertive and cooperative. The collaborator does not avoid the problem. This style seeks to work in conjunction with others to create a solution that satisfies the concerns of all parties. Collaboration means digging into an issue to actually identifying the underlying interests of all parties. The end product is often an alternative that meets each party's sets of concerns. This style may take the form of exploring a disagreement to learn from each other's insights and experiences. Exploration leads the parties to the identification of a condition which, when resolved, would eliminate competition for resources. Collaboration offers a creative response to interpersonal issues. So what are the disadvantages?
Time consuming.
And it takes patience.
Takes patience on everybody's side.
You can't collaborate with an unwilling partner.
Correct.
It automatically sets up competition.
So
you have to all buy into that.
And it does take trust. It takes trust to really collaborate with one another.
And it's partly a work style. Yeah. You know, some people do not work with others easily.
Mm-hmm.
They work independently. So collaboration is larger than just around conflict. It's around how you like to solve problems.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's one brings up, Edie, one of the things we talked about is that there's a little assessment, and maybe we can have everybody do this on another time, but we have usually what's called a default style, you know, just based on our personality and our history, that we just tend to go in that direction. But what we need to learn is to use all of these styles when appropriate. And there's, you know, it can be an appropriate use of all of them.
What I was just saying about collaborating a little bit, building on what Ken said, is it seems like I've had experiences where me or the other person, it's kind of, they sort of say they're collaborating, but there's a kind of hidden agenda, you know, something that really is like sort of competition or power disguised or something. Like it feels very manipulating, you know. I feel like I'm being told, Tim, you're not a good collaborator because because you're not doing what we say.
I mean, I think you can really feel the difference between a real collaboration and the one kind you're talking about at the end, anyway.
These can kind of mask things.
And I think for collaboration to be a productive style, it really presumes that your interests are at least moderately aligned. Right? You're not going to collaborate if, you know, I truly want that and you truly want that. We're just not going to collaborate because there's no way that we can pull those two things together.
Well, unless, and that gets back to the model Kate had, unless you can get to the needs and the stuff under the water, not just the positions. But it would be much harder to collaborate starting from that position.
Some of this, I think, is your own personal style, and some of it is the problem you're discussing sets you up for one of these. Sometimes you're kind of teed up to compete, or you're teed up to avoid, or whatever, depending on what the problem is.
Another disadvantage of collaboration that was mentioned in the class is that if everybody is focused on coming to agreement, they can miss a disadvantage of the resolution. Like, you know, nobody's asking the hard questions.
But it becomes too much about the process and not enough about the content.
Might something might just be overlooked.
So there's a tremendous need for trust building in the organization. in order to get to be able to collaborate
yes.
when it's appropriate, and to compromise when it's appropriate. I think what happens in lots of organizations, including this one, is that a lot of people accommodate because there's the expectation that somebody's leading, and so you better go along with that assumed leader, which may not be true, you know, but there's that expectation, so people do accommodate. They say, well, that looks like the way it is, so I'll go along with that.
I think in this organization, time is a big reason mm-hmm. for accommodating mm-hmm. too, because mm-hmm. you know we don't like to have meetings that go forever,
yeah.
trying to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have so many other lives.
And lots of decisions to make sometimes. Yeah. We have about 5 minutes to nine, so maybe we should stop about
yeah.
now. I don't know if anybody any questions or anything. And we also wanted to know. Because we'll do another presentation at some point. If there's anything you particularly want us to try to talk about, let us know, either now or later.
The hope is that in our quarterly conversations, Sangha conversations, that we'll have some times to practice some skills, some
mm-hmm.
actual set, you know,
mm-hmm.
Example conflicts so we can practice I statements and mm-hmm. various listening techniques and so forth.
How that kind of connects to my question. Did they have you do sort of exercises and different kinds of ways of interacting, or was it mostly kind of didactic?
No.
There weren't any role plays, but they had us do some kind of writing things.
And group discussions.
Group discussions.
Maybe we could do some of those kinds of things.
You know, different active listening skills we practice too, besides that.
Right,
you know,
we already have some ways of practicing active listening, so we can do some of that too.
Yeah, we have some. There's some in here. This is broader. It's interesting because I think the model that we have in our book, it emphasizes a lot of the preparation stages, where we didn't really talk much about that. Mm-hmm. And whereas this program here that they presented offers a lot more of the listening, you know,
mm-hmm.
broader. We just talk about restating, I think, in ours is one of them, but there's, you know, six of them or so in here.
It's good to give us that,
for active listening.
Bob?
I'm also thinking about some of our quarterly Sangha conversations and how we might best utilize them in regards to this type of material. And it seems to me that developing trust is kind of the antidote or the precursor to not avoid conflict, but to so that it doesn't arise as much. You know, if underlying trust has been built, you know, and people know each other,
mm-hmm.
know each other's needs, because it's assuming, I think it's in the assuming about things, about power structures and needs, what somebody else is needing. And I'm thinking of sort of a systemic thing, group-wide, like how different people might assume that power flows in the group just from their own perspective, and then how they choose to sort of fit themselves into that, you know? But if we can air those things and dispel any discrepancies or ideas that might be erroneous and develop a knowledge, you know, where, oh, you understand things this way, I understand things this way, it helps develop a whole level of trust that then I think can help avoid, make it so that conflicts don't arise
mm-hmm.
as much. You know, so I'm wondering if our Sangha conversations could be used to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be something like pre-structuring some specific questions to consider and throw into the group and design those questions, whatever they might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, I think we should probably.
Thank you both very much for sharing.